Real 9. Did this series of tests involving the high explosive bomb and its effects underwater go entirely smoothly?
Not entirely. The CEO thought we might be being much too slow, and he wasn't a scientist, and had a gauge made for us, which was a very heavy phosphor bronze casing with a recording device inside and movable pistons, which would be affected by the pressure in the water. And when we looked at it, we told him it couldn't possibly work because the phosphor, the casting would just break, using it as close to the bomb as we wanted the thing to be. And he said, well, if your little tiny copper disc will stand it, this casting will. Well, of course, we did put it in, but it just collapsed. It was much too rigid. Another of my jobs was to try and photograph targets from an aeroplane at night. There were two obvious lines of attack. One, by means of flare bombs, that was undertaken by the bomb section. They drop bombs suspended from a black parachute, the parachute being lined on the inside with some reflecting foil. And I suppose the bomb was largely magnesium because it went off with a tremendous flash. And the other, which was I was undertaking, was to see if we could take photographs with a searchlight. I had to try various forms of searchlight, particularly various forms of cored carbons. One, the ordinary searchlight with the arc lamp has a solid carbon, which gives its own particular very vivid blue-violet light. And then you can core the carbons. Let's say you have a hollow in the, which you fill up with various chemicals and you can get various coloured lights. The blue light is obviously the better for the ordinary photographic plate, but it won't penetrate mists, which you do get at night so much. So I was trying various types of cores in the carbons. I got the plate makers to make different types of emulsion on the plates. Most of them, I think, were really standard plates. And I had set up the searchlight on this station, and I went to the top of Orford Castle, which I suppose is about a mile away, and they used to shine the searchlight on me, and I'd take photographs of the light and then also on various objects close to me where I took photographs. We did succeed in cutting down the exposure quite a lot, but never did we get to a point where you could take a photograph from a moving aeroplane. And the bombs, the flash bombs, were so much ahead that for all practical uses, the searchlight was washed out. Maybe if we'd gone on, we might have got something, but there was already a much better method. That was the bomb, that we just dropped it.
Did the experiments include fixing the searchlight to the aircraft and trying to photograph from the aircraft?
No, we never got as far as that.
I see.
Because I found that I tried it on various nights when there were mist and nights when it was quite clear. And at the height we should have to be, the exposures were always what you might call more of a time exposure than an instantaneous one. Whereas with the bomb, it was really much simpler because you simply opened your camera lens and dropped your bomb. And the exposure was regulated entirely by the bomb when it went off. And then when after the bomb had gone off, you merely shut your shutter again. Yes, so one of the Hills was a pilot.
Who was Hill?
Well, they were a well-known family of scientists. Weren't they all descended from Rowland Hill, the penny postage man? I think they were all, it was a well-known family. And he came down to see if he could armour an aeroplane in any way so that it could fly into a kite balloon cable without serious damage to him, to itself. We fitted a kind of bowsprit. He was in a pusher. We fitted a kind of bowsprit to it, about 10, 15 feet long, I suppose. And then wires at the end of this bowsprit to these wingtips. And he did deliberately flying into a cable, which caught him on the wire. I didn't see it myself, but I gather there was a pretty good flash, because the kite balloon cable was, of course, earthed, and he was charged according to whatever height he was. And put him into a bit of a spin, but he got out of it all right. But I don't think anything further came of it, because it wasn't a practical means of rendering an aeroplane immune to a kite balloon barrage. That was all that, I think.
Apart from your own experimental work, you must have learned a great deal about, indirectly, you must have learned a great deal about experimental work which was being carried on by the other sections at Orford Ness. What were the outstanding ones?
I think the most important work that was done at Orford Ness was really on navigation. One of the things they used to do was to give a pilot at night instructions, flying instructions, given course for a given time, and then alter the course for another given time, and at the end of a certain period, he had to fire a series of various lights and then turn around and come back. He didn't know where he was going to fire the various lights. It was merely when. And he was supposed to be over a certain town or a certain aerodrome then. And they had observers waiting for him and noted if they saw his various lights and the time and all the rest of it. I think they got pretty accurate in the end with weather forecasting and the navigational instruments and the instructions. The pilot, of course, had to report where he thought he was. He fired the various lights. He had his maps to go by, but he had to follow the actual flight path which was laid down for him in terms of course and time.
Now, did the fact that Orford Ness had an unusual composition in terms of its personnel, with this mix of quite high-powered scientists and professional naval officers, did this create an unusual character to the station?
Yes, I think it did, partly because the people who were at Orford Ness were not selected as professional soldiers and sailors. They were people who were selected there especially to work on scientific subjects. And one wanted pilots who, if possible, with a certain amount of scientific training, who could understand what the object of what they were doing was. And the only really professional soldier was the CO.
Soldier?
He was a soldier. He was a major in the army.
Yes.
And the adjutant was also... I'm not sure whether he was a wartime soldier, but he was a soldier, not a scientist in any way. And discipline was therefore much more relaxed. And I remember on one occasion when some ex-RFC pilots came over to do some sort of thing, and they were quite horrified because they found the major in charge of flying underneath the piano and been pulled out by his sleeves, and one of his sleeves came off because it was most of the stitches were thoroughly rotten with the cast oil, so he always used to fly a camel, which did spew out a lot of cast oil over you. And to see this senior person being hauled out from under a piano and made to play, I think was quite unusual to them. But that went on a lot. And he, this particular, did form a jazz band, a dance band, and my wife and I were also rather keen on music and dancing, and we used to go to his practices in one of the sheds and dance for him, so that he could, if he'd play in a waltz, we could tell him, no, you're not keeping your time accurately enough, or that's too slow. And now, then we'd like rather more emphasis on the time, rather more swing to it. And we'd practice with him like that. And after he was demobilized, he ran his band for quite a time. He's now an eminent aeronautical correspondent.
Did this unusual mix of science and scientists and professional military personnel, did it work fairly smoothly? Were there any problems that arose out of it at all?
I think it worked very smoothly. That when we were... the discipline wasn't so strict, and when we were not at work, we enjoyed ourselves.
Were there any characters at Orfordness that stand out in your mind?
One in particular was Major Charlie, who was a very small man. I don't suppose he weighed more than 8 stone. In civil life, he'd been a transformer designer to one of the big electrical concerns. But he was absolutely full of guts. And one of his jobs was to take a mono camel. That's a camel fitted with an experimental monosuppap engine, up to 20,000 feet every day, irrespective of weather, in order to make weather observations. And Martlesham Heath had just broken the altitude record. I forget what it stood at now, something about 25,000 feet, I suppose, or possibly more, using oxygen. And Charlie said he could beat that without oxygen. You know, he was a teetotaler, a non-smoker, and always kept himself very fit. So he'd selected the day, and off he went in his mono camel. And he got very near to the Martlesham record when lack of oxygen got him, and he fainted. Now, camel is much more stable upside down than the right way up. So his machine just turned upside down and spun down. He got down to a reasonable sort of height, 15,000 feet, something like that, and then came round again. He flew round in circles for a bit and then went up again, watching himself carefully. And he got up to about the same height, still less than Martlesham, felt himself going, so switched off and came down. And I think it took a good deal of guts to faint in the air, turn your machine upside down, and then put it right and then start up again. Mm. He was a great little man. A man called Jones.
This was one of your experimental officers.
Experimental officers, yes. He afterwards became professor of aeronautics at Cambridge. His brother was killed at Orfordness, trying to loop too near the ground. That's about all.